Hello and welcome to The Sci Guys, the show where we talk about the crazy, weird and wonderful stories from the science world. I'm Corey and as always I'm joined by my co-hosts Jemp and Luke Cutford.
Hello.
Hi, howdy.
This week we're talking about medical methods and operant operations, but first we have an Apple review. This one says, "Here from YouTube," and goes on to say, "YouTube led me here, and this is my first time following a podcast. Could listen to you guys talk for hours, so I do just that, lol. Also, sex with robot is weird." I assume that's relevant.
Just throwing that out there.
Sex with robot is weird.
It spoken
is,
from experience.
It is quite, yeah.
Your experience?
Statistically weird.
No, this person's experience.
Okay, good to know. And the question to everyone listening, head over to the YouTube if you are listening, and if you're watching on YouTube, head down to the comments and answer this question. It's for all of you. Have you ever had surgery? Have you ever had surgery?
Probably.
Yes.
Yeah, I've had at least three surgeries. I've had one where they removed a hernia, or they sorted the hernia. I don't actually remember what they did. I don't know if you do remove a hernia. All I know is that there's muscle pushing
through.
They
push through. It back in. And
yeah, yeah, something like that. Yeah. They did something with a hernia. My lung collapsed when I was a baby.
Oh.
I don't know why I'm pointing there. Scar is there.
Point inwards.
And then they thought I had cancer on my shoulder, so they removed a mole. Turns out I didn't.
Just a mole.
Just a mole.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So those are my three surgeries. You guys had any fun? Oh, you had an appendix.
When I was a child, yeah.
Appendix out, didn't you?
Appendix out, nose, face cut open to get a thing inside my sinuses, and then
was it the Lego
my
brick
head
you stuck
open.
Up there?
No, I don't know. I mean, they didn't solve it, so hey, maybe whatever's still in there. And then I cracked my head open, so they sewed it up.
That's not really surgery.
No, I was going to say, if that's surgery.
Yeah, I'm about to do some surgery on my clothes. Yeah.
Got my head glued back together.
That's not surgery. So let's talk about today's episode. Surgery, as we've been talking about, is one of the most complex things that we do, in my opinion. It's just amazing to me that humans have the capacity to learn about human bodies enough that we can just open them up and mess around a bit and then not have the person that owns the body ending up dead from it. And that naturally would then lead you to ask the question, what is the best way to train a surgeon?
Virtual reality.
No.
Surgeon simulator?
With fake people.
No. Well, okay. Ooh. Yes, technically, I guess. Okay.
Dead bodies.
Look, an Ig Nobel Prize winning study took a look into a slightly offbeat method that might actually be useful.
This is not going to involve animals, is it?
Electrocution.
I mean, humans are animals. What is, are you doing operation? Is that the joke there?
No, it's more like if you do surgery wrong, you get electrocuted.
You're just describing operation.
Yeah, but rather than the circuit connecting to a buzzer, it connects to your...
Wow.
Gooch.
Operation is more
Tom
lifelike.
Scott did a video like that, but there wasn't a gooch involved.
Tom Scott did a video where he connected a battery to his gooch and then played Operation.
You're not
That's
seen
a
that video?
Tom Scott video I
want
to watch.
Do you want that phrase that you've just said being on the internet forever? Because it is going to be.
What if Tom Scott comes on one day and he's like, "Ooh, let's look back at this podcast."
There's no "what if Tom Scott comes on one day." When Tom Scott comes on one day, you're going to have to reckon with the fact that you said that on this podcast.
I say I'm "if" sorry, because he's going to watch this clip and go,
"As a side guy's out of context on the Twitter
no,
account."
No, not for me.
Tom, I'm very sorry.
As I said, this study looked into how to train surgeons, and it won an Ig Nobel Prize. So, Luke, I would like for you to ask Jamp to tell us what an Ig Nobel Prize is.
I thought I got away with it.
Jamp, could you... I don't know. Could you please tell me what an Ig Nobel Prize is?
God's sake. That's the fifth time I've done it in this year. Okay, an Ig Nobel Prize is like a Nobel Prize where you get an award for something you've done. I'm getting... Oh, these are getting lazier and lazier. It's like a Nobel Prize. It's for a scientific discovery of some kind, but it's a funny one that makes you laugh, but it actually does make you think because it's discovered something. Okay, I'm sick of describing.
And you
this.
Don't get $1 million.
No, you get one trillion Zimbabwean.
You get a fake banknote for $1 trillion Zimbabwean.
That's it.
And there's a fun ceremony where lots of cool things happen. You know, there's lots of fun things happening with Ig Nobel Prizes. So yes, this study won an Ig Nobel Prize. So let's talk about the sort of, I guess, background for the study. What is operant conditioning? Do you know what operant conditioning is?
I do.
Okay, good.
That's the question.
Is that, you want to elaborate?
It's where you click. You do a little click when someone does something right.
That is an
example. Sorry, could you don't tell me that that's an example. Could you please click so that I'm operantly conditioned?
Click.
No, that. Thank you, Jeff.
I can't snap my fingers.
You could have done it in your mouth.
Well, try harder.
There you go.
There we go. You happy, Luke?
Yes.
Good job. Oh, sorry.
Thank you. I want that every time I correctly answer a question, please.
Okay.
Just for this episode.
You kind of correctly answered a question, so I'll give you a half... Give Luke a clue. Perfect. So, yes, that is an example of operant conditioning. So, operant behavior can be described as behavior that's controlled by its consequences. So you get a sort of response to the behavior that reinforces the behavior, or I guess negatively reinforces the behavior, if that makes sense. So you do a thing you're not supposed to do, and
you go to jail.
No, that doesn't even work. We know this.
Oh yeah.
Yeah. that's a case of negative reinforcement not exactly working.
Okay.
But with operant conditioning, let's talk about where it comes from first. It'll probably give you a better idea of how it works. So it was coined by B.F. Skinner in 1937, and he essentially thought that classic conditioning, Pavlovian sort of conditioning, you know what that is? Do you want to give an explanation of classic conditioning?
Where you learn to associate a stimulus with a different thing. So like the Pavlovian dog response is like you feed, I can't remember the exact example, but like imagine you feed a dog a food that it likes, and every time you also click, when you then later come, once you've sort of trained the dog to associate the food with the click, when you click, the dog will then salivate as if it's about to receive food. It now has a response where clicking causes the salivation.
Yeah, and he thought that classic conditioning, the sort of Pavlovian response, didn't really fully describe the complexities of human behavior. And operant conditioning is kind of the answer to that. So you want to differentiate between behavior that affects the environment and a reflex, or, as I've said, Pavlovian behavior. So, for example, with Pavlov's dogs, you know, you ring the bell or you click and they start to salivate. That's kind of a reflex rather than behavior, right? You know, it's not quite the same as clicking and then the dog runs a marathon. I literally could not think of a single thing that dogs do. What do you train?
Bark.
Thank you. Bark. Dogs backflip.
Backflip.
If I could give you a negative click, I would be giving you such a negative click right now. But jump.
Click in reverse.
But jump. Well, there you go. A little click for you. So that's sort of, I guess, a quick introduction to what operant conditioning is. And I kind of want to then talk a little bit about this study. So they're using clicker training to train surgeons, which sounds a little bit odd, I guess, but clicker training isn't some new thing that is only just now being tried on humans. It's been tried on humans for lots of different things. So Scientific American says that it's been tried on gymnasts, golfers, veterinarians, and children with autism. And on top of that, it's also been done with a lot of animals. So dogs and marine mammals, horses, birds, and lots of other animals that, you know, just hang around humans, I guess. And it's sort of this reward-based sort of conditioning, if that makes sense. As in, with dogs, what you do is you give them a treat and click, and then you give them a treat and click, and you give them a treat and click until they start to associate the click as a good thing. Mm. And then the click becomes essentially the treat, right? So if you get them to associate the treat with the click, when you click, they'll be like, oh man, I feel good.
I feel good right now.
Oh, I feel so good. I feel like I've just been given a treat. So then you can use that to then say, okay, I want my dog to sit. So when I say sit and he sits, I'll click and the dog will feel good. And then it will start to realize that sit means
good.
Sit means sit down.
Yeah.
And it's good when I do that.
Out of interest, does the effect of the click fade? Like when it's not reinforced with food or an actual reward?
Oh, I feel like in a previous... I mean, I've not really looked into this with animals, so I can't answer this question completely certainly based on the research I've done this week. But I think when we were doing our episode on the Little Albert experiment, the background for that showed that the click can fade, I think. That's off the top of my head. Take it with a grain of salt. I think it can. Yes.
Go listen to episode 25. Albert experiment.
So, as I said, it's not the first study of operant conditioning in humans, but I want to talk about this quote from Susan Freeman, who is an applied behavior analyst, and she gave this quote to Scientific American. She said, operant conditioning may be effective across different species because all animals are biologically prepared to behave for an effect. Changing what one does based on the consequences of that behavior is a fundamental phenomenon of the natural world. So essentially what you're doing there is, if you think about this, as a baby, right? If a baby touches a stove and it burns, that's a negative outcome. And then that will then sort of downregulate touching the stove behavior, right? It's going to be like, I don't want to do that. I mean, in babies that are going to survive, right? That's quite a key thing.
Fair, I did that with an iron once and I didn't ever do it again. So
so that's, you can see what we're kind of hijacking there, right? And the reason that you've got the click, that's why you've got to associate the click with sort of good, because you're hijacking this system in animals wherein behavior is sort of regulated by the consequences of said behavior. So good consequences are likely to increase that, the sort of prevalence of that behavior, and negative consequences are likely to decrease the prevalence of that behavior. Luckily with humans, it is much easier than with dogs. You don't need to feed a human treats until they start to think that click is good. You can just tell them the click is good and they'll be like, yes.
Really? Is that easy?
Well, yeah, I mean, okay, think about it. If you know that the click means you've done a good job, here is some praise.
Yeah.
You could be, oh man, I did it good.
Yeah, I can just communicate that to you.
It's just interesting because it sort of suggests that whatever system is training has contextual awareness of the fact that it's good, as opposed to it being some system that's just regulated by something more primal, where like it's like a nice taste that's associated with sugar that's so fundamental to our system, as opposed to the complex contextual awareness of like, you did something that is beneficial to the abstract goal you have, which is to increase the life of the thing you're operating on.
Okay, so put it this way. If something feels good, you will then continue to do it. Yeah. And feeling good can be sort of broad ranging, I guess.
Yeah, I suppose.
You can learn to be helpful to other people, or you can learn to share with other people, because doing that then makes you feel good.
Hmm.
Do you know what I mean? And so in this context, you get a sort of primal rush of feeling good because you know you have done something.
Yeah.
And it's that
you're... that then can feed back into that training system.
Rather than the abstract thought of, I did a good job.
So the abstract thought... So whatever system holds that abstract thought of, I did a good job, is then theory, not necessarily fact, able to create a response that can go... Like, it can create that positive feeling, and then that positive feeling is able to... feedback to those sort of more primal things.
If we're speculating here on how this works and how it works with something more complex, then that would be how I guess I would.
Yeah, super. It. It's like how like a really complicated and complex situation in our world that we definitely didn't evolve to deal with. Like, for example, receiving a negative comment on Instagram, right, can activate like subsystems, give you anxiety, which evolved to make you run away from a predator or something.
Mm-hmm.
Like that's a very specific context of like the new world that can activate very old and deep systems.
I mean, if you think about it as children, sort of how people tend to punish children for doing bad things, that it kind of works in that same way, right? Like, you start to associate, oh, I've done this and now I've got the bad feeling of, I don't know, sitting on the naughty step, you know?
But that could be like the bad feeling is like being removed from other people.
Yeah, in the same sense. Yeah, but in the same primal, though. In the same sense, being removed from other people can be primal, but then also you get a primal rush of like feeling is feeling, right?
Yeah.
If you feel good for having accomplished a task,
yes,
then you're going to, do you know what I mean? You've still got that primal feeling underpinning it, right?
Yeah.
I mean, I guess this is something that it kind of speaks to the fact that all of our systems are just they're very complex because they're fairly simple systems just layered on top of one another over and over and over until you've got this complex human that worries about dying alone.
Yeah. oh, damn. Like,
Wow. You've got a cell, a single-celled organism. You put a bunch of those together, right? You give them enough time, and it's got anxiety.
Yeah. It's like I read once in a psychology book that was talking about how... I don't know if this is true. Again, preface with... don't know if this is true, but I read it in a psychology book that was talking about how like all fears, or at least most fears maybe, are eventually the fear of dying. So you can have like a complex abstract thing in our world, like, oh, you've lost your job as an engineer, which you definitely didn't necessarily evolve to deal with that. But that becomes like, oh, and you might lose access to food. And then if you lose access to food, or you might lose friends because you had friends at work, and then you lose access to food, and then you lose the ability to eat, and then you also lose your house, which means you're more vulnerable to attack, and then you die. Like something, it's ultimately the fear of death, which is a very primal, like probably the most old, the most old impulse you have is to continue existing, followed by make more of yourself. One of those two is probably the most low down impulse you have. But something complex in our world can trigger that thing.
Yeah, I mean, I guess it's what people say when they say that everything comes down to sex, or everything comes down to that sort of fear of death.
Sex or continuing to exist, yeah.
Exactly, yeah. And I guess that makes sense. That makes sense to some degree, and I wouldn't disagree with it on most fronts. I think that it's really difficult because we are so complex. And to be fair, you could explain anything as being a fear of death almost, right? It just takes a little bit of creativity. So I think it's definitely something, I think it's something that's very interesting, but it's also something that's very, very difficult to prove in any meaningful way. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Yeah. So let's actually talk about the study itself. It was done by Martin Levy, or Levi. I never know how to pronounce that name. L-E-V-Y. What do you think?
Levy.
I agree. So when Martin Levy was sort of creating this study, or rather, the idea for this study came from Martin Levy, as I've said, who is a border collie enthusiast, according to Scientific American.
What are you going
to
say? He's a border collie.
He's a border collie, yeah. Martin Levy. He's done very well. It's like Air Bud, you know, that film where the dog plays basketball. There is no rule saying that a dog can't be an orthopedic surgeon.
Oh.
It's other than maybe employment law.
That's the only one.
Are the tools built for their paws?
No.
He's just perseveres, champ. Just
he's got custom tools.
Oh, I guess, yeah.
So when Martin Levy, who is an orthopedic surgeon and not a border collie, but a border collie enthusiast,
he's a Labrador.
When he was agility training his dogs, do you know what agility training is?
Yes, making them agile, like to go around like slaloms and stuff.
So when they're like jumping over the things and through the tunnels and stuff.
Yeah, so I actually have experience with this because I used to go to these dog shows all the time as
someone
a kid.
Trained you to do an agility course.
I mean, technically, Curry's, but I've also trained dogs to do agility courses. It's more what I was talking about.
Okay.
Yeah, so an agility course, it's kind of the slaloming thing. Yeah, it's got that. That's one element of it. They can go up sort of like ramps and down ramps. There's the seesaw. It's kind of a little obstacle course for your dog. Border collies are especially good at it because they're some of the smartest dogs out there.
You would say that as a border collie yourself.
Yes. If you're listening to this and you've never watched the YouTube, head on over to the YouTube channel because you will see that I am, in fact, a talking dog.
I'm not editing this.
Woof, woof, bark, bark. You don't need to edit it, Jamp. You can stop editing the human man that you usually edit into these videos and leave me in my true dog.
Take off the filter. Take off the filter.
I find that offensive.
Oh.
You don't know what you're saying, man.
Just hurl a bunch of slurs across the table.
You just said the dog N-word, bro. It's like 10 times as bad.
Oh, dear.
Ding-a-ling-ling, it's the ad bell. What are we advertising today?
We're advertising our spicy merch. I am wearing the tardigrade beanie that we're selling. That's a little tardigrade boy, little water bear going, ooh.
And if you like the tardigrade beanie, you could also get our matching tardigrade t-shirt with a little smiling tardigrade that isn't going ooh, but is going ee.
And if you like the tardigrade t-shirt, you might also like the Sci Guys little pin badges we've made.
Wow.
They don't match, but they do say Sci Guys, and you can show your love for Sci Guys in your pin badge collection, and they're very cute.
Yeah, it's the actual logo.
And there's still a chance to grab our Sci Guys calendar, which will give you a discount on the future calendar if you get it now.
And an extra episode of Sci Guys, all about calendars.
Yeah. Oh, wow. Yeah, they will get
calendar
that.
Calendar episode, yeah.
Well, that's the spawn from ourselves. Back to the episode.
So when Martin Levy, who is an orthopedic surgeon and border collie enthusiast, was training his border collies at agility, essentially a little doggy obstacle course, he realized that he might be able to use the same technique on actual surgeons. So he realized that essentially dogs were very good at training dogs, right? That was his kind of takeaway. I've got a quote here, actually, from him saying, "Over time, I started to realize that we had better tools for training our dogs than our residents." So he realized, oh yeah, we're pretty bad at training surgeons. We're actually not very good at it. But we're very good at training dogs. Maybe we could do something there to make those two things kind of the same. So he spoke to Catherine Pryor, who's an animal trainer, and a number of other things, and they created the training program for the study. So the usual training methods for surgeons, what do you think that would be? The sort of general way that they would normally train surgeons? How would they let them know that they've done a good job, or how would they let them know that they're doing the sort of right thing, or what not to do? What's the sort of...
Do they grade them?
They do grade them, but what I've got here is generally that it's focused on negative reinforcement. So you get in trouble for doing things incorrectly rather than praised for doing things correctly.
You've killed him.
Exactly. How dare you?
The patient's gone.
Little electric
shock. It's a real life patient. Oh, dear.
Yes. Luke's Gooch idea was actually very, very close. But hypothetical here. Let's say, scientifically speaking, the most effective way of training surgeons to do surgery was to give them electric shocks whenever they got it wrong. Do you think that's what we would do?
No.
Oh, really? If it was the most effective?
If it was,
probably, yeah.
If it was without a doubt shown to be the most effective method by a decent margin, right? By a good margin.
They probably
not an insurmountable margin, but a decent margin. Do you think we would do it?
They'd get people to consent to it and then they'd do it, 100%.
Really?
100%.
You think they wouldn't do it?
I don't think they'd do it in our country, no.
I think they would.
Well, so to get the best surgical education, you'd have to travel
to it. Yeah, because they'd be like, I'm not settling for second best.
Yeah, I don't know.
Not the best trained surgeons ever.
I feel like people would think it was too silly to do.
Yeah. Oh, no, I don't think people would think it was too silly. Especially highly motivated people, which surgeons maybe would be.
I mean the systems, not the individuals who want to learn surgery. I mean the people who are creating, I guess, the education systems for people to learn surgery, you know?
So what was the negative reinforcement they were using if they weren't giving them electric shocks?
Verbal negative reinforcement.
But that's nowhere near as effective as an electric shock, I'm sure.
Words hurt.
Like, you're not getting anywhere near as motivated with just, like, bad job than you are with an electric shock to the gooch.
Some people have been killed by words.
And nobody's been killed by an electric shock to the gooch, as far as I know. So, I'm just saying, we haven't tried it. What about using this little clicky version and an electric shock to the gooch? You get a click if you're good, you get an electric shock to the gooch if you're bad.
I feel like the
have a race of super surgeons.
I feel like the electric shock would render the click just irrelevant. In fact, the click would probably be the relief.
It'd
of,
be like, oh,
oh, thank God.
Thank God. Yeah, well, that's good then, isn't it? That's a big rush. Okay, right. I'm not getting an electric shock to the gooch.
So,
what if they trained people who were into getting shocked in the gooch?
Oh, so man.
It'd be positive reinforcement.
Yeah, so then you just flip it around. Yeah.
They hate clicks. Oh, no. You put the click really close. The click means you're not getting a shock to the gooch. Like,
oh, damn. Oh, no. No, so they don't shock anyone's gooch. That's not what happens here. They use negative reinforcement, verbal negative reinforcement, as in being sort of made fun of, really. I saw that they were derided for getting things wrong. You know, in terms of like, oh, come on, how could you be, like, that was such a stupid mistake. How could you do that?
Stupid!
That's the left ventricle, you utter buffoon.
You imbecile!
I feel like an orthopedic surgeon should not be going anywhere near the left ventricle, so.
Well, that's why that's why they're getting bullied.
How did you get in there?
This is a leg amputation. So there's actually a quote from Levy in Scientific American saying, there is a saying in the field, without tension, there is no retention. Essentially, you don't remember it if we're not making you feel uncomfortable.
You don't feel a bit bad.
I don't agree with that, actually. I don't agree with that at all. I feel like adding more tension makes you feel worse and makes it harder to learn things.
Yeah.
Yeah. Like, I retain stuff here, you know, without any tension. I retain so many of the things that I read and learn for this podcast.
A lot of time, it discourages people from trying.
Exactly.
I know in video games that punish you for failing, I usually give up on them eventually.
Yeah.
Because
yeah.
I'm just like, I'm sick of you punishing me for getting things wrong. Like the slightest thing.
I think there's a healthy level of you should get some kind of negative reinforcement. Yeah. Right, negative reinforcement can work, absolutely. But there's a limit to it, and I feel like positive reinforcement is probably the better option. Especially when you've got students who are very stressed and just trying to learn how to do some surgery. Please, yeah. please let us learn to do the surgery. So that is sort of the inception of the study, why they decided to do the study. Here are the aims of the study. They essentially want to break down surgical techniques into simple constituent parts and find whether an operant conditioning training method is more effective than the traditional training method. So as you are well aware, operant conditioning doesn't necessarily work with very sort of complex behaviors. You know, it's hard to sort of train something as complex as do surgery right, because there's lots of things going on in surgery and lots of things you could do wrong. So what you do is just break down the surgical techniques into simpler techniques, and then you could use clicker training on those simplified techniques. And then you could string all of the sort of simplified techniques together, and boom, you've got the surgical technique.
This is actually really interesting. So I'm currently reading a book by the guy. Do you guys know the sort of state of mind that is referred to as flow?
Yes, right. I was reading about this recently.
So I've been reading this book by... So Flow State Jam.
Explain.
And for anybody
me.
Who doesn't know, I won't be able to give you a perfect definition of it. But basically, I think flow state is generally the experience you have when it feels like you sort of lose yourself and you are entirely focused on the task at hand. You often lose sense of time. And it's basically where you are in a
zone.
Yeah, in the zone, exactly. Right, where the thing you're focused on is your entire being, and you might lose sense of time, you might lose sense of self, that sort of thing.
I'll say this: Soul, the film Soul, very well explained that sort of, or visualized that sort of experience.
Oh, really?
You know, so it's the Pixar film. They've got a very, very good visualization of. The experience of being in that sort of flow state. Yeah.
And one of the things, so it basically breaks down, this book breaks down some of the sort of things that are necessary to enter into the state of flow. One of the things it gives is, firstly, it's where your the difficulty of something and your skill are like roughly matched. So it's like slightly pushing you, but you're also very well equipped to handle that that situation. So it's almost like the opposite of being comfortable.
Mm-hmm.
But where being comfortable is like you don't need any skill to be comfortable, and you also there aren't many stakes, right? Whereas flow state would be sort of the situation whereby like the stakes are high, but you're also well equipped to deal with those stakes.
Mm.
And then you sort of, it's almost like if you're a great rally car driver, right? Or you're like people will often or you're great like climbing the side of a mountain, but you're a great climber. People will like seek out activities in order to get into the state of flow, because it's such an interesting and exciting state to be in. Anyway, that's the background. The point is that it details these sort of things that are necessary for flow state, and one of them is that you know what your task is and you're receiving feedback on how you're doing at your task. And this is almost like this operant conditioning is sort of helping you get into a state of flow, because you have a well-defined task. For example, you've broken down the large task of surgery into smaller tasks. You have a well-defined task, and then you're receiving feedback on how you're doing in the form of a click. And so it might be actually that this is helping you get into that flow state, where actually you might, in flow state, you're often better at the thing you're trying to do, specifically because of the state you're in.
Well, that definitely makes sense. I think it might make more sense as we look more into the actual study itself. So we're talking a little bit about the aim. As I said, part of it is to break down the surgical techniques and just train people on them with this new method. So I guess one main sort of question that is being asked here, whether this new methodology is more effective at training surgeons on these techniques than the traditional methodology. The traditional methodology. That is basically the only thing that they're looking at. So it's a pretty straightforward study. I mean, it's not a very difficult read either, I would say. I would definitely recommend reading through it. It's pretty interesting. So there are two main techniques. There's tying the locking sliding knot and making a low angle drill hole. So It doesn't matter. You don't even know what these are.
Sounds like DIY horrifying terms.
Yeah, it's basically tying a knot in a specific way, and then also drilling a hole in a bone, essentially.
God.
Yeah.
Ow.
Well, yeah, it's not a real bone. They just use PVC pipe instead
of... Yeah, they're going to do it on someone eventually.
Yeah, but the person's going to be like under anesthetic. You're not going to feel none of that. Not back in the, Victorian era? Is that... It was Victorian era. We weren't using anesthetics in the Victorian era.
No, just got them drunk.
Really?
Were they drilling holes in people?
I don't know if it's the Victorian era, but one of the ways, like one of the early forms of anesthetic was basically just to get the patient very drunk.
Yeah. Whereas nowadays, if you're drunk, that's a real pain because they can't really give you very much when you're drunk. They don't want to interact. Yeah. But when you're drunk, actually, let's say you fall out a window when you're drunk, you will sort of ragdoll, which might lead you to being less injured.
That's true.
Than if you fall, say, down the stairs when you're sober. You know, because when you're sober, you'll tense up when you fall, which is just not, you don't necessarily want to tense up because that's going to lead you to hit things and give more sort of resistance and then injure yourself more. But ragdoll and you just fall, you're probably going to be not totally fine, but probably fare a little bit better. Yeah.
It's really interesting. It's almost like we haven't evolved to effectively deal with falls. It sort of made me notice the fact that actually falling is probably a lot more common in the world we've built than it would have been in the world before we built a world.
Well, falling down stairs,
You fall off cliffs and stuff, but like there aren't that many cliffs, whereas we deal with stairs all the time.
It's pretty tough to fall off a cliff as well. You gotta want to fall off a cliff if you're gonna fall off the cliff.
If only
or you got pushed
down
off
down
the cliff.
Then, I mean, how often are you standing on a cliff's edge with your buddy who is going to betray you, you know?
Yeah.
That's only happened to me.
Massive amount of evolutionary pressure there.
Yeah, there's only happened to me like three times, you know? So like, how often is that actually gonna happen?
The Lion King is deceiving. It doesn't happen that much.
No, but we'd fall out of trees.
Yeah, but falling out of trees is, I think, fundamentally different to falling out falling down the stairs.
Yeah.
I feel like falling out of a tree...
You actually want to be as rigid as possible when you fall out of a tree.
No, but if you're falling... Well, think about it. When you're falling, usually, you know, if you're falling out of a tree or something, there is something to grab.
Yeah, true.
You know, you can... You want to be like, and you can break your fall that way.
Yeah.
And also, there's lots of branches to slow you down, whereas if you fall down the stairs or something like that, those stairs aren't slowing you down. They're just hitting... There's
just takes you to the next one, and the next one.
Yeah, wait till you fall down an up escalator. That one, just doesn't
let you. You never hit the ground,
or you never stop hitting the ground. So yeah, that's I don't even know where we were. We're going back to tying the locking sliding knot and making a low angle drill hole. So those were the two things that they taught, obviously. These were both sort of taught using the control, which was essentially they had someone sort of teach it to them and show them how to do it and sort of do it in their own less sort of structured way, I guess. And the second way, the actual sort of way that they studied, was just they would be shown how to do it in a neutral way, and then they would be asked to perform it themselves, and whenever they sort of got it right, they would hear a click, and that was the only sort of feedback. Or they would be told good, just a neutral, good, you know?
Yeah.
Whereas...
good.
The control...
good. Good. Is that neutral? I think that's actually not neutral.
Quite menacing.
A neutral good.
Good.
In what tone of voice?
Good.
Good.
A neutral voice.
What's a neutral voice?
Good.
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 That's quite positive, though.
Well, it's because the word good.
I guess so.
Right? Bad.
Good.
No, it's easy because... Okay, right, sure. Now, if you are encouraging if you're encouraging a father to use the force to destroy his estranged son, that
good
would be a perfect...
Anakin.
I actually, if I was training as a surgeon, I would specifically want to be very good at surgery just so I could hear whatever the heck Jamp just did. I'd be like really excited. That would motivate me so much.
Okay.
But I'd then probably giggle and like cut open someone's leg artery or something.
Cut your jugular.
So for the test learners, so these are the ones that were being taught using the operant conditioning method, they were taught one-on-one by a single senior surgeon who was also trained in operant. The operant learning methods. So this is direct from the paper itself. So they used the methodology, they followed a very specific script, and they essentially told them what the goal of the sort of, I guess, technique was. They gave them some background information on the technique, and they demonstrated the technique. And they also then sort of identified the first step of the technique, and then they gave them instructions and demonstrated the behavior. And they would then sort of carry on that way, right? Mm-hmm. So you break it, you show them, you sort of give them a background, you show them the whole technique, then you show them the first step of the technique, mm-hmm. And you explain that, and you then click when the test subject does it right. Mm-hmm. So they then had them sort of do this behavior, sort of repeat it 5 times, and it was sort of built up throughout the learning process. You would do one, and then you would move on to sort of doing one, and then the next one, and then one, and the next one, and the next one. And the idea was that they would sort of do it until they get it right, and then they would do it sort of a few more times. And they took all of this sort of information and they put it all together. With the control people, there wasn't a sort of script to it. You know, it was they just had 2 demonstrations and then verbal instructions by a single instructor. And then they were given a sort of full diagram of the knot, and then they were asked to construct it. And they also, in sort of both of these cases, they recorded how long it took for them to get the first correct knot. And then they had to do it, I think, maybe 4 more times, or they were given like 15 minutes to do as much as they could. The sort of specifics here aren't super important. Essentially, what you need to understand is that the control and the test people were being taught in different ways. That was what they were testing. They were being taught in 2 quite different ways.
Yeah.
With the control people being given a sort of more unstructured explanation, demonstration, and diagram, and the test learners being given this operant methodology that was very strict and followed a specific script. So it was, I guess, standardized across everyone.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah? That all makes sense?
Yes.
Mm.
And so that was tying the locking sliding knot, and making a low angle drill hole was essentially just drilling into a PVC pipe with a literal drill. I can tell you what kind of drill it was if you're interested.
Please.
Yeah? You sure?
Yeah.
It was a 12-volt cordless drill, DeWalt Industrial Tool Company, Baltimore, Maryland, USA.
That's literally the drill that I have.
Is that literally the drill you've got? It's a very popular drill, it seems. Yeah.
Well, we can do a video where we teach ourselves.
Yeah, I'll drill into your leg and Corey can click when I do it right.
Okay.
How about I scream when you do it wrong?
No, because that would be negative. That would be bullying culture.
Luke?
It's not as effective.
No.
It's not as effective. No. You know it's not as effective.
Shock his gooch.
You can shock my gooch whilst clicking when I get it right, if you like.
Both at the same time must work extra well.
Yeah, okay, sure, that's fine, yeah.
We can finally do that test, the combined gooch shock plus operant conditioning test, and then we can write a paper about it.
I feel like there might be some confounding variables, so let's first just shock your gooch. To make sure that that's working. And then, if you're happy with the good shocks, we can then maybe move on to drilling a hole in my leg, yeah?
Oh, no, it's Jamp's leg.
Oh, Jamp's leg?
Yeah, fine.
Oh, okay, so if we're drilling a hole in Jamp's femur, then that's all good. Yeah, no, let's go ahead. Let's do that first.
Fantastic.
Nice. Oh, he's not going to stop you. He's just going to let you keep drilling.
Well, Luke is a very, very good student, and I doubt he'll make any mistakes.
I've used my drill quite a lot too, so I'm quite good with the drill.
So I actually just want to give you a quote from the paper itself about making a low angle drill hole, because it's again an example of a paper being specific and that just being very funny to me. So it says, for this submodule, both the test group and the control group were asked to learn to make a low angle drill hole. For this case, a drill hole that was 45 degrees to a tangent of circular polyvinyl chloride pipe using an 1/8 inch drill bit and a 12-volt cordless drill. They go on to tell you what the drill is. I love that they say circular polyvinyl chloride pipe and PVC. Not just PVC pipe.
Yeah.
As though when you picture a PVC pipe, you might picture anything else that is anything else other than a circular polyvinyl chloride pipe.
It's a very long way of saying one of those drain pipes.
Yeah, you know one of those drain pipes?
Yeah.
We drilled the hole in it, 45 degrees.
Yeah.
Good.
With a normal drill that you'd pick up at B&Q.
Exactly. So In this one, they used first and second year medical students, and they just randomly sort of selected them from a group of people that volunteered. And in this study, so they were using sort of different groups of people between each of the sort of control and test groups. So in some cases, they were using first and second year medical students. In other cases, I think they were using sort of postgraduate students. It sounds like it might be an issue, but actually in this sort of experiment, the techniques that they were learning, it wasn't actually a huge issue because they hadn't learned those techniques before. So any of them. So there wasn't going to be a huge issue there with them being sort of different levels of education. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So just in case you're reading it through it and you're like, hey, why are they using different levels of student? Because it doesn't hugely matter for the actual experiment. So again, they were taught one-on-one for the test group by a single senior surgeon who was trained in operant conditioning methods and all of that sort of stuff. They were given the background. It was broken down into constituent parts, and they had to sort of go through that. And again, there was a clicker for whenever they'd actually done the behavior correctly. And so again, they learned it sort of in succession and linked them together into a chain so that they had the entire behavior sort of down. Yeah. And apparently learners averaged 20 practice holes and were limited by the available space on the practice pipe. So they were given 10 minutes to then, once they, I think they got it right, they were given sort of 10 minutes to then just do it. And the limiting factor here was that they didn't have enough pipe. They were drilling that pipe faster than, okay.
I feel like when I start drilling into Jamp's leg, the limiting factor is going to be how much leg he has.
That's so true, because I feel like Jamp would pass out pretty quick.
I'm not going to have 20 tries, am I? Well, if he passes out, that's fine. I've still got his leg.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. Well, okay, so there's
two legs, actually.
I think the quicker So the quicker that Jamp passes out, the better, right?
For him.
Less struggle. Well, yeah. for all of us, really.
Yeah, I don't have to listen to the screams.
Exactly. Yeah. Right? As soon as they fall silent. And then...
it's quite dark. I don't like this talk.
And then you can drill as much as you want. You run out a leg. You've got a second one.
Get a PVC pipe.
Maybe. Do we really want to be wasting PVC pipe?
That's true.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Think of the environment, Luke.
It's very expensive.
That's so rude.
Yeah, it would be rude to waste PVC pipe when it could be put to better use, wouldn't it?
My legs could be put to good use.
I
could be planting some PVC.
Planting some PVC.
Wherever PVC grows.
No.
The PVC tree? No?
No.
No? Okay.
So the control learner had two demonstrations and verbal instructions. Again, not as strictly controlled as the test groups, the people that were being given the operant conditioning, these guys,
the subjects,
the actual subjects, the control people, they were just taught whatever, essentially. Not whatever, they were taught in a less structured way.
And were they bullied?
Know? No, well, they weren't bullied, Luke. They were just taught in the normal way.
I suppose
it maybe involves some level of bullying, but it doesn't say in the paper whether or not they were bullied, but they probably were.
Potato.
I think I was bullied by my English teacher, but in an operant conditioning way.
Elaborate,
so,
please.
Okay, so he would do this thing. I mean, he was a brilliant teacher. And so that was the headline. I was bullied by my English teacher. But he was actually a brilliant teacher. But it was an operant conditioning. He wasn't doing negative reinforcement, but it kind of felt like it was. Like, imagine you got your click when you got it right.
Mm-hmm.
But then when you didn't get the click, instead of there being a lack of click, you felt a deep existential shame. So what he would do is, like, he'd ask a question. And then if you got it right, he'd be like, Luke. Cut forth. Oh. And then he'd look around the class and be like, can we all appreciate Luke Cutforth's answer there? And we'd all clap the answer. And then if you didn't get the question right, he'd look at you and then he'd just turn away from you and ask a different person. And it really worked. You wanted to please him so much.
Oh, no.
It was amazing.
I feel like, is that not just positive reinforcement done very well?
It's like positive reinforcement, but it does introduce negative reinforcement, but with, like, plausible deniability of the negative reinforcement.
Oh. I will say that must have been a very long class if every single time he asked a question, he went around the class to get a round of applause.
It was a 5-minute speech. Yeah,
not a literal round. I mean, he would just basically encourage everybody else to appreciate how brilliant your answer was. And then everyone would nod with the brilliance of the answer.
So this is what I was saying. You should do the gooch shock.
Yeah.
And also the clicks at the same time. So you can get the best possible outcome.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
That's what I'm saying too, Jim.
He's giving you a round of applause.
Yeah.
For a good answer. And he's giving you a cold, like, look and then a look away.
But he was just brilliant. It was like, I'm fully down with the operant conditioning, but it should be like applause from the rest of the students instead. Yeah.
I feel like I have learned some things about how to run this podcast now.
Yeah.
I'll take that.
So when we do the quickfire quiz and one of us gets it right, I want you to go, oh, Jamp. Can we just all appreciate Jamp's answer here? Woo! Woo! And if one of us gets it wrong, you just stare and turn to the other one.
That's all he does anyway.
Jamp. Would you like to answer, please? Would you like to spare us from this horrible performance?
Deary me.
I think he does that already.
That is soul-crushing.
It was incredibly effective, though.
Wow. Yeah.
I got 100% in all my coursework.
Oh.
So we've now understood kind of how they ran the experiment. You both get it, right? They had two techniques that they wanted to look at. Basically broke them down into two different ways of learning those techniques, and they tested to see which one was more effective. What do you think the results might have been?
I think positive is better.
Do you want to elaborate on what you mean by that?
I think the positive reinforcement probably was more effective.
Yeah, so the operant conditioning.
Yes.
So, yeah, well, what do you mean by more effective? Because that's a very important distinction. Oh.
They learned quicker.
And probably more efficient or something, as in like...
More of them passed their exams.
So it wasn't about actually training them to pass actual exams, I feel like that.
As in like a fake exam at the end where you then get one chance to drill correctly and more of them got it right.
So what they...
Because you only really get one chance when you're drilling through a leg.
Mm. He got two legs.
You're generally not operating on both legs, though. And it will be a problem if you mess one of the legs up.
Now, look, here's what happened. We messed up one of your legs, but luckily, we found out you had two during the operation. So we just went ahead and did the amputation on the second one.
But I didn't need the other one amputated.
Yeah!
Have you left the leg with the problem?
Yeah, but here's the thing.
I got the operation right, so it's fine.
It's gone all green and black, so it'll probably fall off at some point. But in the meantime, you can get used to having one leg, huh?
But I only have my gout leg left.
Oh, God.
My only good leg is gone forever.
Oh, God. That's why I think that's one of the reasons that surgeons fully will just draw on the leg that they need to... That they need to sort of operate.
Oh, yeah. So you don't get it wrong.
Because if you think about it, it seems a very silly mistake to make, but it is an incredibly easy mistake to make. You know, you need to know for sure what thing you're doing.
Yeah, if you're not paying attention, it's 50-50.
It's actually 50-50. Dear me. So, yeah, it was, I guess, a more effective trading method, but here's a quote to kind of give you an idea. He found that the residents in an operant learning group and a traditional learning group could perform the two tasks at about the same speed. However, the students in the operant group were more precise in their movements and performed the tasks more proficiently. So it doesn't make you any faster at doing it, but it does make you more precise, which in surgery is a
good thing.
Mm.
Yes, you're right. It is a good thing in surgery to be more precise.
I think that's generally good across the board.
I mean, let's say you're an archer who is up against a close friend. Then it serves to not be precise.
It depends what your goal is.
I suppose it serves to be inaccurate. It serves to be precise and inaccurate. Yeah, okay. Never mind. You're right, Luke. It does serve to be precise.
There aren't many places in which being imprecise is a benefit.
Yeah, it's tough to think of one, isn't it?
Yeah, probably because there aren't any.
Imprecision.
Oh. Unless your goal is to be imprecise.
Oh, that's one where being imprecise is probably a good thing, yeah.
But then you want to be... What if you are imprecise at being imprecise? Then you're just precise again.
People are listening to this pod. This has very quickly become one of those podcasts where people think that they're fun to listen to because they're having fun with their mates. Mm. But in actuality, they are just talking about nothing.
Yeah.
Bored out of their mind. Yeah, every example I can think of is imprecise on purpose. So it's actually kind of precise.
I think the notion of precise means that your goal is to be precise.
I am making an executive decision here and saying that we are no longer discussing whether there are situations where it serves to be imprecise.
Mm. Should we hold a vote?
No, vote is necessary. Okay. I'm making an executive decision. This is me saying we're doing this.
Who granted you your powers?
Dumbledore. I don't know, man. Jesus.
Dumbledore.
Jesus did.
Who Jesus.
Knows? Yeah, Jesus and Dumbledore. Same guy, actually.
I
thought so.
Anyway.
So what's been said about this? Levy himself has said, when we talk to the attending surgeons, they can say anecdotally that residents who learned with the new methods seemed better prepared. So obviously that's an anecdotal outcome of the sort of the research. But they did find that there was a greater degree of precision within the sort of within the test group. So operant learning might be a useful way to actually train surgeons. And that's probably why this won an Ig Nobel Prize. And we've got another quote here from Susan Friedman, who I've already mentioned before, is a psychologist and applied behavior analyst. She has said that the findings are plausible, and when you move, when your motive is to escape an adverse stimulus such as shouting or ridicule, you behave only as much as you need to, but then when the motive is to get something you want, you do more than is needed. And she wasn't involved in these experiments at all, but that would be her explanation of this, and I kind of agree with it, right? You know, I found this at jobs where, you know, where I've been working, say in a bar or in a restaurant. If you don't do enough work, you get in trouble. Mm-hmm. If you do enough work, or more than enough work, you get more work.
No, you get more work, exactly.
You maybe get some.
You raise the bar.
You maybe get some praise sometimes, but I don't. There's no personal benefit to. There's no personal benefit to working harder. There is only a personal detriment to not working hard enough. So very quickly, what you find out how to do, or what I found out how to do in my first job, was do exactly as much as is expected of you, and then sometimes a little bit more. And you'll be fine.
I've also noticed a lot in the film industry, right? So I'm somebody who as far as I understand myself, I intend to follow through on things that I'm going to do, right? So I intend to I would like to direct a movie, say, and I intend to try my hardest to do that, right? And then the industry is also full of charlatans who are not intending to follow through on the promises they make. And are intending to, and this is not just the film industry, there's loads of industries that are like this. It's full of people who are sort of, they have a lot of chat and they're not actually going to do any of the things they say they're going to do. And it turns out that an awful lot of the difficulties of making it in the film industry, not all of them, but some of the difficulties of making it in the film industry, are because there are checks, naturally evolved checks for people who are not going to follow through on their promises. And if you're somebody who actually loves it and really wants to get there, you're slowed down by the fact that you have to prove yourself as because of the checks and balances that are there, that have evolved to be there because lots of people are charlatans. And that is so frustrating. It's understandable, but as somebody who just really passionately wants to do something fully intends to do it to the best of their ability all the time, it's so annoying because I'm going into these meetings and I'm like, I'm spending a lot of time proving to you that I'm not something that I'm not.
Yeah.
Because there are some people who are the thing and pretend to not be it.
Yeah.
And it's like, oh my God.
Just ruining it for the rest
so
of
annoying.
You. So annoying. Goodness me. Well, we got quite off track from the actual topic, but we more or less covered everything. So I guess it's now time for... a quick quiz.
Dun, 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 dun. Doggy surgery edition. Doggy surgeon? Doggy surgeon edition.
No, yeah, he's not like dogs. Has it taken you this like long? Oh, right. Okay.
You train them like dogs.
Okay.
So they're like little doggies, but they're humans.
No.
The rules of the quickfire quiz are the same as always. I will ask one question. That's one question between the two of you. The first person to buzz in with the correct answer after finish asks the question wins. What do they win, champ?
Some drill surgery.
No. Oh, the Lord, no. You better hope you don't win this one.
Oh, no.
Luke, what is your buzzer? Jamp, what is your buzzer? My question for you both is, what was the positive reinforcement in the experiment? Luke, that's correct. Well done.
Yeah.
But you didn't buzz in with your answer.
Yes, I did. Oh, you're confused. That was my buzzer.
No. Congratulations, Luke. Well done. Well done. The answer was, just say it again. No, say the answer, please. Okay, it was
clicking.
It was a click. Yeah. Well done. Before we go, we'd like to thank all of our patrons with a very special thank you to executive producers Rosa Rodriguez and Danito. And also, thank you for listening. You can find the full references for this episode down in the description. Subscribe for new episodes every Monday. And why not leave us a nice wee review? You can support the pod at patreon.com/SciGuys, or you can find and contact us at SciGuysPod on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, and here on YouTube, and at SciGuys on TikTok too. Or you can send us email at SciGuysPod@gmail.com.
That's SciGuysPod@gmail.com.
SciGuysPod@gmail.com.
You can follow me at NotCorey everywhere.
You can follow me at Jamkin everywhere.
You can follow me at Luke Cutforth everywhere.
This is a click to give you positive reinforcement for finishing a SciGuys episode.
So that you do it more often.
We'll click at the end of every SciGuys episode. You got to listen to the end for the click. Goodbye.